Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, car accidents are the leading cause of deaths among children, but getting young drivers to understand the ramifications of getting behind the wheel when under the influence is not always easy. We'll hear the approach one school is taking. There's a new plan to change how Illinois funds higher education. We'll take a closer look. With early voting getting underway next month, election officials are already planning for what should be a busy time. They're also battling misinformation. We'll visit the Western Illinois community of New Philadelphia. It's historic in that it's the first town to be legally platted by a formerly enslaved individual. We also look back at the cultural impact of a TV show set right here in Illinois. And we remember a familiar voice to many public radio listeners. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. And this is Statewide. Thanks for being with us. I'm Sean Crawford. Alcohol-impaired car crashes cost communities north of $58 billion in medical costs, legal expenses, and lives lost. That's according to recent federal data. Around 17% of teenagers say they've been a passenger of a driver who wasn't sober. Side Effects Public Media's Elizabeth Gabriel reports how one school in Indiana is trying to educate teens and curb impaired driving.
Four different interactive activities are set up around a room at Westfield High School. Each station aims to teach students how driving under the influence of alcohol and drugs impacts motor function. The first station seems simple. Kids just have to walk in a straight line. And at first, they do it pretty easily. But then they put on what looks like ski goggles. Their purpose is to simulate what it would be like driving while impaired.
I'll have you guys walk it just simply, kind of just heel to toe, and see how easy it is to walk that line. And then we'll try it with the goggles.
The impaired driving goggles make the room slightly different colors and cause double vision. It's kind of like looking into a kaleidoscope. That's when things get tough.
Because I thought I was doing really good, and I literally didn't even put my big toe on the gray line.
That's Elizabeth Snowden, a rising senior. She was at least a foot away from that line.
I didn't think it was going to be like that bad, but I thought I was doing good, but I wasn't.
No!
You think you're in your lane, but you're in the oncoming lane.
That's crazy.
Lane. Right, so you got a car coming at you now. And you don't even realize it.
I didn't even touch the gray line. That's funny.
Right?
Substances like alcohol and marijuana can impair someone's coordination and judgment.
I can't see anything like here.
Which is right what I was talking about, the depth perception, right? So you're having a hard time seeing how far away your feet are?
Billy Adams is the drug recognition expert for the Westfield Police Department. He helped lead the interactive presentation.
Some of them, they did make comments of, well, what if I just close my eyes? I can walk on the line fine. Well, you can't close your eyes and drive.
Adam says the activity taught kids there isn't a foolproof way to drive safely while impaired.
I also tried to explain to them that your vision is one small piece of what being impaired does to your ability to drive. Now, you think walking with these goggles is hard. Now imagine if 10 other parts of your body were being impaired at the same time.
Car crashes are the leading cause of death for U.S. children, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Recent data shows more than 150,000 young people were injured in alcohol-related car crashes in 2022. Early awareness is crucial. That's because studies show adolescents who rode with someone driving under the influence were more likely to have DUI charges as adults. But school districts may struggle to determine the best way to do so, says Bonnie Helpern-Felsher. She is a developmental psychologist with Stanford University. She says using fear tactics like showing pictures of someone dead in a seatbelt may not work.
The problem with scaring them or saying, if you do X, Y will definitely happen. So if you drive drunk, you will get into an accident. The problem is, if none of those things happen, it's as if we've lied to the teen and they don't believe us anymore.
Researchers say hands-on simulations could potentially work, but there is still not enough research to show how effective they are. Jesse West is a teenager at Westfield. He says he doesn't drink, and he thinks the simulation will not end impaired driving, but he's hopeful it will at least reduce it.
If I have a friend that's drinking, maybe I shouldn't even be in the car with them.
And I never really understood how serious it can be and how reliant you are on like kind of muscle memory. And at our age, we only at most 2 years into driving. So that muscle memory isn't going to be good enough.
Researchers suggest teachers and parents stress the importance of knowing how different substances affect someone, being in safe places away from vehicles or open windows, and calling 911 if someone is sick or passes out. Elizabeth Gabriel, Side Effects Public Media.
Side Effects Public Media is a health reporting collaboration of NPR member stations across the Midwest. Migrant children in Chicago are adjusting to their new lives, and their parents know it's been a long and dangerous journey for them, sometimes crossing a jungle. A new soccer program gives the kids a chance to do what many 8 to 10-year-olds are doing this summer, playing outside. Adriana Cardona-Magiga takes us to a soccer field.
On a recent afternoon, a group of about 15 migrant children quickly put on their cleats and shin guards as volunteers signal that soccer practice is about to start at Skinner Park. The kids are part of a six-week summer program that runs twice a week. Gilbert Benavides is a 10-year-old from Venezuela. He says what he loves most about the program is that he gets to play his favorite sport with friends. The kids start with warm-up and team-building exercises. And after that, they start kicking the ball. A group of college students started this ad hoc program because they wanted to offer something unique to migrant children.
Soccer can be used as a universal language.
Hannah McGee is a pre-med student at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign.
And like these kids just went through such a hard journey to get here. And you know, they're the ones that need like some support and outlet to let their energy out and just some consistency.
She and other volunteers passed flyers around parks and a few nearby city-run migrant shelters, letting parents know about the program. Most of the children come from two of those shelters. Student Sofia Castro coordinated donations from friends, family, and local soccer groups.
We set up a GoFundMe and we sent it to family friends and we were able to get $1,000.
They also got donated cleats, jerseys, and socks that kids get to keep at the end of the program. Irene Santos, a new arrival from Venezuela, sits on a bench with her husband close to where the kids are playing. They both watch their 8-year-old son, Matias, run around. She says, Matias is always jumping around. He loves playing.
Le gusta mucho lo que es el fútbol, los juegos, le gusta participar. Y pues lo trajimos por acá porque le encanta.
She wanted him to do something fun and support his passion for soccer. But she didn't know where to take him at first. The city's Park District official summer programs are on high demand. The registration process is hard to navigate and transportation can be a barrier. Other summer camps are expensive. Skinner Park has been great for her son. Other parents say it's hard for their kids to play in the shelters. They have strict rules and kids aren't allowed to run around and be loud. After running and playing soccer for a while, the kids sit on the grass and have snacks. Gilbert's family used to live in a shelter, not anymore. But now he gets to play with friends he made when he lived there. Most recently, Copa America, the international soccer tournament, brought excitement and disappointment. But Gilbert and his friends are inspired to keep playing soccer regardless. Back in the field, all they want is to keep kicking the ball, imitating their favorite soccer stars. It's a chance for them to just be kids, running, laughing, and hanging out with their friends. And for a moment, the harrowing journey to get here is just a memory. Adriana Cardona-Magigat, WBEC News.
The Democratic National Convention dominated news this week. Illinois' governor got to deliver a primetime address at the United Center. J.B. Pritzker's speech painted Illinois' values in contrast to Donald Trump's. Tessa Weinberg and Mabwa Iqbal have more on that story. Tessa starts us off.
Governor J.B. Pritzker walked out to chants of J.B. from the Illinois delegation. As he took the stage to promote Kamala Harris as the Democratic presidential nominee.
Welcome to Chicago, great American city in a proud blue state. Our patriotism was formed in frost and in fire.
But there are no signs of bitterness that Pritzker had been passed over to be her VP. Instead, Illinois, the state of four presidents, including Barack Obama, calls Harris one of their own, he says.
We claim her too!
But he quickly turned, devoting much of his speech to attacking Donald Trump, even referring to Michael Jordan's now famous quote from the documentary The Last Dance.
Donald Trump once called Chicago embarrassing. To quote a great Chicagoan who won six world championships on these very grounds, we take that personally!
Pritzker's speech came immediately after Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who at one point said billionaires should not be allowed to buy elections. It could have been an awkward moment for Pritzker, who is a billionaire. The Hyatt heir has poured just under $350 million of his own fortune into his own campaign. But Pritzker confronted his own personal wealth head-on as a foil to Trump to rowdy cheers.
Donald Trump thinks that we should trust him on the economy because he claims to be very rich. But take it from an actual billionaire. Trump is rich in only one thing, stupidity.
Pritzker says Harris and Walz will lead with kindness instead.
I'm Mawa Iqbal. I caught up with Illinois Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton in the United Center after Pritzker's speech. She told me that she calls Pritzker her friend, having been his running mate since 2019 when Pritzker assumed his role as governor. She says watching him speak, she was filled with a sense of pride.
He's going to be a partner to soon-to-be President Harris to help make sure that not just Illinoisans but all across our country that we're protecting reproductive freedoms, that we are making sure that people can live safe from gun violence, that we are expanding access to jobs and economic opportunity.
Meanwhile, State Representative Jahan Gordon Booth says while the convention feels like a party, there is still work left to do. And Pritzker, Gordon Booth says, is the rising political star to do it.
And he is not driven in the same way that most people that I have seen in this business. And I think that when you're driven in the manner in which he's driven, it comes from a very deep place. It has to be something. And it's not just power.
Pritzker says he may run for a third term, but it's too early to start thinking about that. And he skirted around questions on whether he would ever run for president. He says his political future may ultimately be up to his wife, First Lady of Illinois, M.K. Pritzker. Asked with an earshot whether her husband should run for governor again, MK laughed off the question on the crowded convention floor.
I can't hear you.
We can't do anything.
Regardless of her decision, Pritzker will already be the longest serving Democratic governor of Illinois at the end of his term. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
And I'm Tessa Weinberg.
Radio and TV broadcaster Jay Pierce died this week after a short battle with pancreatic cancer. Brady Johnson of member station WVIK in Rock Island has this remembrance.
Good morning from WVIK News. I'm Jay Pierce.
That was Jay Pierce hosting WVIK's Morning Edition podcast back in 2022. Pierce was known as a compassionate, driven individual who dedicated 40 years to TV and radio, half of that time working in public broadcasting. The native of Detroit grew up in the Chicago suburb of Winnetka and graduated from Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. Those who knew Jay remember him as a person who values community above all else and went above and beyond in helping his fellow broadcasters. Mike Savage is the WEKU Director and General Manager, an NPR station in Richmond, Kentucky, and he remembers first meeting Pierce in Central Illinois when he was managing a newly opened public radio station. Savage was attempting to hold the station's first fundraising drive. Pierce was working at WILL, an NPR station in Champaign-Urbana, at the time.
So he took a day of leave. He took a vacation day, and he drove up, and he pitched on the air and helped me raise money for my station, which was just kind of the guy that Jay was.
He remembers Pierce's desire to offer something more than just a station on autopilot and recommended him to join the NPR's board of directors in 2015 until his retirement from WVIK in 2022. WILL Jim Meadows started at the Champaign-Urbana station back in 2000. At that time, Pierce was the WILL station manager and AM program director. He remembers Pierce's dedication in informing the community during the September 11th attacks. Meadows says in a statement to WVIK, quote, "He interrupted the network feed at WILL to read AP bulletins about the attacks, adding updates as they came in. I remember hearing him on the car radio as I drove to work. I had not listened or watched any news at breakfast that morning, so Jay's news bulletins was the first I heard of it." In late 2011, Pierce moved to the Quad Cities to work as WVIK's station general manager. Augustana College Executive Vice President Kent Barnes remembers hiring Jay for the position and immediately impressed with his experience and personality. Barnes says he cherishes hearing Jay on Morning Edition.
He loved that show, loved that craft, loved sharing with others, and it was just such a warm, comforting moment. Jay Pierce was there as a live host.
Former WVIK News Director Herb Trix met Jay at a broadcasting convention over 25 years ago.
Well, the fact that he was willing to do Morning Edition for many years, he thought we needed to do it better with very few station managers that are willing to get up at ungodly hours to work the morning shift.
Barnes, Savage, and Trix all credit Pierce for steering WVIK in the right direction.
It was at a time when WVIK needed to be reinvented, and Jay was the right guy to do it. He had vision, he had drive, he didn't back down from challenges.
Trix echoes Barnes' sentiment to Jay's dedication to public radio.
He was good at talking with donors and potential donors and helping to convince them to support the station. So, you know, it's not just being a good radio guy. You have to be good out in the community, too, and I think he was excellent at that.
Pierce was involved in numerous organizations. Recently, he was the executive director of the Illinois Public Broadcasting Council, and during his battle with cancer, he was the co-host of the Pancreatic Cancer Cast with his brother, Gary Pierce. J. Harold Pierce was 69 years old. Brady Johnson, WVIK News.
And he will be missed. We've got more to come on Statewide. Stay right here. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. A measure in Illinois would transform how the state funds higher education. Peter Medlin brings us the story.
NIU President Lisa Freeman served on the state's Commission on Equitable Public University Funding, and their task was to create a data-driven approach to funding higher ed. That's because Freeman says right now, there is no formula. She says it's largely, what did you get last year, and then all public universities get a flat increase or decrease. And Freeman says it's an unfair system because schools are different. Some have larger endowments than others or serve more low-income students.
We need a funding formula that's rational, that considers the size of the institution, the mission of the institution, and the type of students that the institution serves, because all of those have significant direct impact on the money you have to provide students with the experience that they expect, need, and deserve.
The NIU president says a funding formula would also provide much-needed stability year to year. She says universities typically don't know how much money they'll receive until later in the fiscal year, which makes long-term planning more difficult.
We have to guess, and having to guess means we have to be conservative, means sometimes we can't get ahead of lengthy procurement processes, we miss opportunities for growth, and it's very frustrating to the entire campus.
Freeman sat on the commission alongside students, professors, education nonprofit leaders, and legislators. Illinois Senate Majority Leader Kimberly Lightford was a co-chair on the commission, and she compared this process to when the state changed how K-12 education was funded back in 2017, which she was a key part of.
It took us years to do, and it was very political. And that's a part of why I created the commission, because I didn't want it to be legislative driven. I didn't want it to be a politically driven. I wanted it to be expert driven.
Lightford says the K-12 funding formula has been successful so far and inspired the push to do the same for higher ed. For example, both formulas are based around adequacy targets, calculating how much total money an institution would need to provide instruction and services, and how far they are from that funding target now. She says no Illinois public university is adequately funded now, and the commission's report shows that the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign would be the closest to adequacy, and Northeastern Illinois University is furthest from adequacy, although the numbers aren't final. The formula weighs multiple factors unique to each school, like the cost of instruction, operations and maintenance, student services, and number of low-income students. Lisa Freeman says it also considers the university's mission, like NIU's.
We have a distinct identity of combining access with a strong research mission. Our research mission requires investment, and supporting students who come from underserved communities requires an investment.
Speaking of investment, Senator Lightford's new bill requests a lot of additional higher ed spending.
Our new formula at $135 million new dollars a year for the next 10 years. That will move everyone to adequacy.
Freeman says for years, state funding went down, which caused tuition to go up. From 2000 to 2020, state investment in colleges and universities in Illinois dropped by 46%, and tuition and fees doubled. Freeman says the lack of investment hurts enrollment, and some students leave the state for cheaper universities, and many low-income students simply can't afford to go to college at all. Over the past decade, Illinois public university enrollment is down 7%, and Freeman says the extra cash would make public universities more affordable and allow them to invest in student services to help them succeed once they're at school.
I think of academic support services, more peer tutoring, more advisors, earlier career services.
Senator Lightford says there would be a review panel to tweak the formula as they go, and they also have an accountability system tracking how funding is directed, if schools are taking steps to lower student costs, if enrollment is increasing, and student outcomes. And she says the bill's now filed, but the work isn't done yet. They hope this new bill and a new way of funding higher ed marks a new era for Illinois public universities, one that's more affordable and more stable than the past few decades. I'm Peter Medlin.
Early voting gets underway September 26th, and local election officials are gearing up. As Maria Gardner-Lara reports, that includes combating misinformation.
Lori Gummo has served as a Winnebago County Clerk since 2018. She says changes in the top of the Democratic ticket have not affected her office, since they haven't started working on the ballot yet.
We don't do anything until the state Board of Elections certifies to us.
She says they'll likely receive the final list of candidates in late August after the Democratic National Convention. In the meantime, there's a lot to do leading up to the November election, like reviewing the voter rolls. And Gummo says the list of voters is very fluid.
There's people that pass away. There's people that move into town. There's people that move out of town. There's people that turn 18. Our number changes every day.
She says the Illinois Board of Election also verifies their voter lists. She says it's about ensuring election integrity. It's something she often gets asked about.
I am always reassuring the public that our elections are safe and secure.
When asked if she knows of any cases of non-citizens voting, which has been a fear propped up by some Republicans, she replies in the negative.
Not that I am aware of. And I also, similarly, I hear people who say there are deceased voters, but I am not aware of any deceased people voting either.
She adds, disinformation on social media doesn't help.
So I think sometimes the rhetoric on social media is loud, and we need to turn that off.
Some legislators, including Republican State Representative John Cabello of McChesney Park and State Senator Dave Severson of Cherry Valley, have been vocal about their opposition to state laws that make it easier for folks to vote. That includes a measure which doesn't require voters to show a government ID to vote in person. Voter advocate groups say it's about increasing voter accessibility, while some Republicans suggest it weakens election integrity. Gummo says she doesn't take a position on election laws, but doesn't share their concern.
I think they forget that, but they do have to present identification in order to register to vote.
So what if you register to vote via the mail? In that instance, you'll be required to show an ID at the clerk's office prior to an election or at the time you cast your ballot at a polling location. And while concerns about election integrity may be a talking point during this election season, the Illinois Board of Elections spokesperson Matt Dietrich says there's no evidence of wide-scale fraud.
No, we don't have any evidence of that. That would be someone impersonating another voter.
He adds election clerks and law enforcement are vigilant for potential cases of fraud. Gummo says election integrity is also about making sure that every vote is counted. And that means a lot given there's been very close local races.
Since I have been here, there has been, I believe, 5 races determined by the slightest margin.
In the March primary, the differences between the Winnebago County Board 3rd District Republican candidates was 5 votes. Just 5.
Again, a lot of times I'll hear people say, oh, my vote doesn't matter. Well, to that candidate, your vote mattered.
Like other candidates who lose with such a small margin, they may request a discovery or review of the votes.
And I have to say, every single time we were spot on. There was no problems, there was no issues, and the numbers were still the same.
I'm Maria Gardner Lara.
Urban farmers who want to buy land often look to vacant lots. It seems like a win-win for the farmers and the city. The farmers get the land they need and can bring more food security to their neighborhoods, and the vacant lots are taken care of while the city gets more green space. But as Eva Tesfai with Harvest Public Media reports, urban farmers often struggle to get that land.
Mediatrice Nyankuru moved to Kansas City 7 years ago from East Africa. For the last several years, she's grown crops here that you might not normally see in the Midwest, like these African plants.
Cassava leaves, mchicha, and white eggplant.
Originally from Burundi, Nyankuru is part of a farm training program in Kansas City, Kansas, called New Roots for Refugees. It trains participants on farming methods and helps them establish their own businesses. Nyankuru recently graduated, and she's moving on to a piece of land she bought with another farmer. But it's not as big as she'd like.
You see, my garden is still small. But the problem, too, is no water.
The lack of water access and the inability to buy more land has kept them from moving off of the New Roots training farm. It's only supposed to be a 4-year program. But program manager Semra Fetahovic says it's been increasingly difficult for their farmers to acquire land. So they end up staying longer.
This year, we're actually leasing land to 6 graduates that can still rent land here. Next year, I think that number will be 10.
For many of their farmers, it's been difficult to get a hold of the owners of vacant lots, who often live elsewhere. Even if they do get in touch, the owners may not want to sell.
I think that's a really big frustration being in an urban setting, is you just see so many vacant lots, yet the owners like don't want to let go of them.
There's a multitude of private actors in that space, right? Likely some of whom are people holding on to it, hoping it goes up.
Janelle O'Keefe is from the Center for Community Progress, a national nonprofit that helps cities deal with systemic vacancy. One of the ways that cities do that is by starting a land bank, a department that acquires vacant land and sells it. O'Keefe says farmers often have to deal with both land banks and private owners, as cities typically only own a portion of the vacant land. And land banks aren't always excited about selling those lots for farms and gardens.
What we've seen through conversations and work we've done is the prevailing notion that the highest and best use of a property is something bricks and mortar.
Detroit is a city that is known for having a lot of vacant land. Its land bank has about 60,000 vacant lots. Since a land bank was formed in 2008, it's been a little easier to buy property. That's according to Tapfira Rushton. She's the co-founder of Detroit Black Farmer Land Fund.
We've come a long way, and we have a ways to go.
Rushton says before the land bank, there were lots of different entities that owned vacant land and no clear process on how to buy it. But even with the Detroit Land Bank Authority, she says the city still doesn't prioritize urban gardening.
It's a secondary priority. not even a secondary. It's like a cute thing that people are doing in their eyes.
Rushton believes that land access would get easier if cities just recognize the value of urban farms. A land bank spokesperson said their goal is to return these properties to productive use. Back in Kansas City, Kansas, the land bank only sold one property to an urban farm in the past 2 years. It prioritizes single-family housing. Andrew Davis is a commissioner for the unified government of Wyandotte County and Kansas City, Kansas.
I don't think we have to choose.
Davis says the land bank is in the process of changing its policies, and he thinks there's enough land to go around.
I think there's a way in which we can gardens and farmers thrive in KCK, all while still having that aggressive movement for single-family homes.
But he also says many of his colleagues don't agree, especially because houses generate more property taxes than gardens. Urban farmers argue they bring their own value to neighborhoods with productive green spaces and healthy food. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Eva Tesfai.
The Funk family recently celebrated 200 years of farming in McLean County. Along the way, members of the family befriended Abraham Lincoln and helped bring hybrid corn to America. That and more is recorded in Pioneers Built from the Soil Up, a history of the Funk family, published this summer by the family itself. The author is Chris Bodenner, a former editor of The Atlantic. He spoke with Jim Meadows about Isaac Funk, who, with his brother Absalom, introduced the family farm.
He's a remarkable figure, how he was able to come into Central Illinois, you know, with no inheritance, no family name of recognition. He was able to, from the soil up, build arguably the largest, most valuable estate and farming empire in Illinois and the Midwest in general.
How did the Funk brothers manage to prosper at a time when certainly a lot of farms struggled, especially during the financial panics or depressions that happened periodically during the 19th century?
Isaac had 10 children with his wife in Illinois. Their children had lots of children themselves, which leads to the founding of the Funk Brothers Seed Company in the early 20th century. Isaac Funk, although he had very little education, was very savvy, built a cattle trading network from scratch in Central Illinois. He, you know, is arguably the most successful early cowboy.
He was also active politically. Is that an important part of Isaac Funk's legacy?
Yeah, very much so. Isaac Funk served in the Illinois General Assembly in the lower house with Abraham Lincoln in the early 1840s as part of the Whig Party. During that term, became very close and lifelong friends with Lincoln. And Isaac went on to become one of his biggest and like most influential advocates within Illinois. During the Civil War, Isaac was called back into public service when one of the Illinois senators went off to serve on the battlefield. Isaac was 63 years old at the time and became a fierce advocate for Republicans. It sort of culminates in this very dramatic speech he gave in 1863 called the Copperhead Speech. Very briefly, Copperheads were Democrats who wanted to end the war against the Confederates without the Confederates surrendering. I mean, Copperheads were seen as traitorous and undermining Lincoln's cause. Isaac sort of stood up during this dispute over funding Lincoln and Union soldiers. He stood up sort of spontaneously and gave this very rousing speech against the Copperheads that was splashed across newspapers around the country.
I'm really jumping ahead here, but you did mention the Funk Brothers Seed Company in the 20th century and the advances that the Funk family made in hybrid corn at that time. Mm-hmm. How did that come about?
Well, about a decade before hybrid corn was first developed scientifically was the founding of the seed company just at the turn of the century. The Funk Brothers Seed Company became arguably the most influential seed company in the world. E.D. Funk, he was the president of the company, of the family affair. He was a grandson of Isaac. The process of hybrid corn is a very long, complicated process. But E.D. Funk and his right-hand man, Jim Hulbert, who was the more scientifically trained, they were right at the center of that small group of men. And I think E.D. Funk stands out as the most influential promoter of hybrid corn to very skeptical farmers. I mean, you couldn't use its seeds to grow the next generation, but they had a remarkable ability to combine the best traits of different strains of corn into one that created yields that the world had never seen before, and on less land as well.
That's Chris Bodener talking about the Funk farming family of central Illinois. The family sold its seed corn operation in the 1960s, but family members continue to farm in McLean County, producing corn, soybeans, beef, and maple syrup. Bodener's book about the family is titled Pioneers Built from the Soil Up: How the Funk Family Shaped American History, and it's available on Amazon. More to come on Statewide. Stay right here. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. 50 years ago, a groundbreaking sitcom debuted on TV. Good Times featured a black family keeping their heads above water. They lived in the Cabrini Green public housing development in Chicago. Michael Puente has a story reflecting on the show's legacy.
Twin brothers Maurice and Marvin Edwards were youngsters in 1974. They were being raised by a single mother and three siblings in tough conditions in the Cabrini Green housing development on Chicago's Near North Side.
So I definitely thought it was tough because it was times I didn't think I would make it to be 16 years old.
Maurice was 5 years old when his family moved to Cabrini Green. His twin brother Marvin didn't like his surroundings much either.
And some of the things that was going on as far as the crime and, just having to fight going to school and to fight to go home because the bullies wanted to pick on you and the gangs wanted to recruit you.
The brothers recalled their mother having tough times paying bills, getting food on the table, and just having the basics. Their neighbors were going through the same thing, including one who lived in the TV. The show featured the Evans family, mom, dad, three kids, showing the real struggles of poverty and, at the same time, racial pride in various episodes. The show ran for 6 seasons, starring the late Esther Rolle as the matriarch Florida Evans and John Amos as the father James.
James, we got a pleasant surprise for you. Tonight we are having fresh collard greens, chitlins, and pork chops.
Hey, that's a Sunday meal. What'd you do, hijack a supermarket, girl?
To Maurice Edwards, they were real neighbors.
I really thought that this family lived somewhere in Cabrini Green, and it really freaked me out.
Good Times was created by Mike Evans of the Jeffersons and Eric Monte, a Chicago native, and developed by the legendary Norman Lear. While American sitcoms often depicted a sanitized version of real life, Marvin Edwards says the show was spot on.
110% accurate. Not just living in Cabrini Green, living across the city of Chicago, period.
I do hold it in high esteem. And for me, it's personal and professional. I mean, I was 10 years old when the show came out.
Bowling Green State University professor Angela Nelson loves Good Times so much, she's writing a book about it. She grew up in rural South Carolina and knew nothing about city life, but she connected with the show's depiction of a loving black family and says it was the first TV show featuring a black family led by a two-parent household.
And they were different from Father Knows Best and the Donna Reed Show. They didn't have the economical type of financial grounding that the white families in these other sitcoms had, but they were a loving family and they were doing their best to make it.
Felicia D. Henderson is a longtime Hollywood writer. Today, she's a professor at Northwestern University. She says many people relate to the characters on Good Times and have their favorite episode.
My father loved Good Times. He would laugh as if he'd never seen the episode ever. He loved JJ.
The show did catch criticism. Jimmy Walker's character, JJ, became the breakout star with the help of his catchphrase,
"He's dynamite!"
Some saw JJ as playing to a negative stereotype.
Is it perfect? No. Does JJ have sort of buffoon-like moments? Yes. But is he mostly just the family clown, like we all have one in our family? I have that brother.
Henderson says Good Times plays an important role then and now.
We saw an intact black family that loved each other, who came together to, solve complicated problems.
Much of Cabrini Green is now gone and replaced by mixed-income apartments and new retail developments. Maurice Edwards is still connected to the place he grew up. He's the president of the local tenant council and is helping the National Public Housing Museum collect favorite episodes of the show for an exhibit debuting this summer. Michael Puente, WBEZ News.
A small Pike County town rich in history has made headlines nearly 200 years after it was founded. New Philadelphia made a name for itself in 1836 when it became the first community legally registered and platted by a formerly enslaved person. Last year, the town site became the nation's 424th national park. At that time, Marissa Ann Lewis Thompson reported on it, and today we revisit that story.
New Philadelphia sits along a strip of Illinois Route 2, roughly 25 miles east of Hannibal. The property is an open field with towering trees scattered throughout. The original structures are all but gone, except for their foundations, sitting beneath wooden homes from the 1800s, moved there from neighboring towns. But what has lasted are the stories passed down about the town's founders, the McWhorters, a last name full of history.
One of the important, powerful messages was really about the importance of family.
Gerald McWhorter is the great-great-grandson of Frank and Lucy McWhorter.
What Frank and Lucy did was devote their lives, really, to making sure that, on the one hand, they provided a place for the family in Pike County in New Philadelphia. At the same time, they devoted their economic activity to freeing family members out of slavery.
In 1836, New Philadelphia became the first town in the nation to be legally registered and laid out by the formerly enslaved couple. Frank was born into slavery in 1777 in South Carolina. He and his owner, George McWhorter, eventually relocated to Pulaski County, Kentucky. There, Frank was able to hire out.
There were certain conditions under which a slave could hire out, meaning go to work for someone else, or to have some level of entrepreneurship. And then most of that money would go to their owner, but they would be able to save some of that money.
Frank set up his own saltpeter mining operation just in time for the War of 1812. Saltpeter is an ingredient in gunpowder. He was able to turn a profit and save enough money to make good on a dream he and his wife Lucy long had for their family, freedom.
Lucy and Frank decided that the first person to be freed from slavery would be Lucy, because she was pregnant, and they wanted their next child, who was a son named Squire, they wanted that he would be born free.
Frank bought Lucy's freedom in 1817. 2 years later, he bought his own. He ultimately bought 16 other family members' freedom, including the couple's other children. The McWhorters eventually left Kentucky and made their way to Pike County, Illinois. Sight unseen, Frank purchased 42 acres of land. But there was one thing Frank was worried about, the H in his last name, McWhorter.
The usual name spelling for McWhorter is W-H-O-R-T-E-R. And he took the H out because he did not want the former slave owners to be able to come to Illinois and claim his property.
Even though Frank was living as a free man in Illinois, that did not mean he had the right to stop people from laying claim to his land. Christopher Fennell is a professor of anthropology and law at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He says Frank was strategic.
He hires an attorney and they go to Springfield and file the paperwork at that time to create a bill in the state legislature that would give him all the rights, responsibilities, and capacities of someone who's classified as white under the Illinois laws and the national laws as they impacted the area at that time.
In 1837, the Illinois General Assembly passed the McWhorter Law, securing his rights. New Philadelphia would go on to become an integrated abolitionist farm town. It was even a stop on the Underground Railroad. Here's Gerald McWhorter again.
If you think about the Underground Railroad, the people that passed through New Philadelphia, their family descendants may not even know their connection to New Philadelphia. So when we talk about New Philadelphia as our family story, one of the things that the national parks status enables us to do is to go from our story to our story, the bigger our.
Things were stable for a while until a group of white businessmen from Missouri pushed for a railroad to be constructed. It would come across Pike County, connecting Hannibal, Missouri to Naples, Illinois. They wanted to turn Hannibal into a major commercial hub, says Fennell. But there was one problem.
These white business people in the slave state of Missouri in 1857 did not want to see this thriving African-American town, which was a commercial hub, become an even more thriving depot town. And so they actually spent more money in bypassing it.
Black-founded towns in the U.S. were frequently snubbed. It essentially cut off further opportunities for economic growth. But that was just the beginning of the promising town's decline. Many residents left for large metropolitan areas like Chicago and Kansas City for work. Here's Gerald McWhorter again.
As a family farm ceases to be the norm and agribusiness tends to dominate, there continues to be migration out of the rural area. So this is a general pattern that goes way back and continues to today.
New Philadelphia dissolved in 1885, but the McWhorter descendants and the people in surrounding communities never forgot about New Philadelphia. The New Philadelphia Association, a group made up of descendants and community members, has worked to preserve the town. The site has since gone on to be listed on the National Register of Historic Places, a National Historic Landmark, and in December, the New Philadelphia National Historic Site became the U.S.'s 424th national park. Gerald says this designation was a long time coming.
And this story is really the story of a man and a woman who loved their family and did what you would hope people would do for their family. And because they were situated at a particular point in history, in a particular situation as African-Americans, et cetera, it symbolizes something that is way beyond the individual reality of a family. It's really a biopsy of a people.
Becoming a national park did not happen overnight. Mike Ward is the Deputy Regional Director for Operations and Facilities in the Midwest region for the National Park Service. He says typically national parks are made through the Antiquities Act or an act of Congress, but New Philadelphia was different.
It was placed in what's called an Omnibus Act, which is a very large bill that included budget and all kinds of other things where some of the senators from Illinois decided that they wanted to create New Philadelphia.
The Park Service is still in the early planning stages of what they have in store for the site, but Ward says the New Philadelphia Association is making their job easier. The group has already set up a visitor center, an augmented reality tour, and signage. And the newly dubbed National Park already gets regular visitors. And on this particular windy day in New Philadelphia, a busload of nearly 40 fourth graders from Western Elementary School in Barry dropped by. The kids had just started a unit on little-known Illinois history. They'd watched a video about it that morning, but what they did not know is that their teachers, including Jeff Fessler, had a surprise for them.
So the kids were very excited about it. We didn't tell them we were coming here. And then right as recess ended, a bus pulled up and we said, we're getting on that bus. And they said, what? Where are we going? And they discovered about 5 minutes in, they saw a sign and said, we're going to see New Philadelphia.
Are you guys excited to be out here today?
Yes.
What a surprise.
Yeah,
I like
the history of New Philadelphia.
Why? Come close, don't back away.
Because, you know, it's exciting for me to learn about New Philadelphia, and plus it's fun to be out here in the nature and learn about stuff we haven't learned and back in the past.
So basically, you get to do history the fun way.
Yes.
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 We get to do histories every single day. It's like, it's as if we were, and I had no idea this was our surprise, but as soon as we were on our bus heading this way, I said we were heading to New Philadelphia.
So you just already knew.
This one girl, Isla, she was going, we're going to New Philadelphia. Yeah. I'm like, dude.
But there was a reason for Isla Moss's excitement.
Because, like, sometimes when you're going to a field trip, you don't know what to expect. Like, when you're finally here, you're just like, what's going to happen? What are we going to do? And then you look around and all you just see is, like, fun. And you think about, like, what's been in the past and how they were and, like, how they worked and how they lived.
For Gerald McWhorter, he wants to continue to see the next generation of kids with this much excitement about his great-great-grandparents' story, now that it's made its way to the national stage.
That's the wonder and joy of what's possible with young people who are open and not conditioned by the prejudice and the weakness of older people. And that's one of the interesting things about the New Philadelphia story, is that it really is spreading.
The National Park Service is still in the process of securing the rest of the land that made up New Philadelphia. The Park Service will also hold community conversations with stakeholders. In New Philadelphia, Illinois, I'm Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson, St. Louis Public Radio.
We're out of time for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. Join us next time. We'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois public radio stations.